This is Radio Eco Shop with your host, Alex Smith.
Last week, while people huddled in their homes to slow the pandemic, a string of strange and strong tornadoes struck the American South, and wild storms knocked out power to about 1 million people in the Northeast. Extreme weather, hot oceans, and the coming heat waves tell us climate change has not self-isolated to fit the times. Now we have double anxiety, where even the safe and the dependable are suspect. We are literally out of touch with people we love. How can we grow out of that? Margaret Klein Salomon was a clinical psychologist in New York City. Then Hurricane Sandy struck. Life was not the same, and Margaret's journey took a big turn towards facing the climate threat. In June of 2015, I interviewed Margaret about the climate mobilization movement she organized. Since then, cities and countries unbelievably over the world have declared a climate emergency. Now Margaret has a timely new book out, Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth. Let's find out if that still works during the battle against coronavirus. Margaret Klein Salomon, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
Okay, so we have no ideas what emotions are developing in people shocked by the sudden shutdown of their lives that we all knew and so many deaths. Could these be the same emotions that come out when we realize our climate is in a frightening crisis as well?
In any kind of emergency situation like this that disrupts normal life in the present and calls the future into question, there's a range of emotions that we experience, and of course, all in a, you know, idiosyncratic and personalized way. But some key feelings that are widely shared are fear or terror, sadness, anger or rage, guilt or shame. These are really both coronavirus and the climate are overwhelming global issues that threaten lives and stability. So it makes sense that they bring up, you know, really the full spectrum of human emotion. But I think the two most important, most deserving of our attention and analysis are fear and grief.
As I have told you, this is one place where I slightly disagree with your book in the sense that I personally have not gone through a period of crying about the climate or deep grief. I've been heartbroken about some loss of species in the coral, and I'm worried. But in general, I feel more invigorated, like I just want to get going and do as much as I can about it.
The ultimate goal of my book is to move people into action, from pain into action. And if you can get there in one way and someone else gets in there a different way, then, you know, God bless. The critical thing is to be fighting to protect humanity and all life. Not everybody has to have the same experience. For many, let's say, the reckoning with the fact that the future is going to be dramatically different from the present, that the industrialized, globalized, consumerist world that we live in is in its last gasp, and our options are transform or collapse, and that we're headed straight for collapse. Those kinds of realizations can devastate people looking at climate truth. And to really integrate them, to really feel them and take them seriously and give them the attention that they deserve, that reality, the emotional process of grieving and really feeling the losses, both of human life, non-human life, and again, the future, our hopes and dreams and plans, I think for many is best described as a grieving process.
What is the state of mental health in America in general? Can you give us any of the stats?
Mental health in the United States could be better, let's say, where this concept of deaths of despair are on the rise, and that includes suicide, opiate, deaths where people have lost their motivation and their hope and their mission in life. So, yeah, 1 in 6 Americans take psychiatric medications. Opioids kill more Americans than car crashes. The average American watches 33 hours of TV a week, and I imagine that that would be even higher during this self-isolation time. So it can be hard to take a snapshot of a country's mental health, right? Obviously, some people are doing better than others and so forth, but I think broadly speaking, we are stressed, we are anxious, we are depressed, and we are dissociating in front of screens.
Now, many years ago, I read the work of psychoanalyst and anti-nuclear activist Eric Fromm. Could you talk to us about his view of what Sigmund Freud called the death instinct and how that applies to our situation and climate anxiety?
Yeah, Eric Fromm is an intellectual hero of mine and an activist hero. He played a really critical part in helping the United States and Soviet Union avoid nuclear war through, you know, psychological interpretation and helping both countries save face. Yeah, I'd always love to talk about Eric Fromm. And Eric Fromm's theory about loving life is so important. Eric Fromm said, most people have never met a healthy person. That achieving what he viewed as psychological health is actually very challenging, especially in a country that's so alienated and has so much advertising and, you know, just consumerism, competition, and so forth. It's very challenging to actually gain autonomy, morality, the feeling of empowerment to be able to make a difference in the world. And Eric Fromm said that if people feel disempowered, they feel like they can't create and nurture life or actively take part in the creation process of art or of a company or an organization or, you know, making things happen in the world. If you can't be creative and engaged in life and feel good about yourself, then there is kind of a dark side of humanity, which he calls necrophilia, the love of death. So when people are frustrated and feel worthless and stuck and helpless, that they actually are okay with the fact, or even seek destruction and collapse and decay, because they already feel so badly inside that the idea of the world ending, it feels normal, natural, fitting. Eric Fromm wrote that he wrote an anti-nuclear paper, anti-nuclear weapons, that argued people need to love life. Because if they did, then we would never allow these weapons of mass destruction to threaten us all. And in the same way, I think that the bad feelings that people have about themselves and our society make it so when they hear, the climate is collapsing and there's going to be state failure and droughts and famines and horrible chaos, they think, all right, that's, it feels kind of normal to them because it is something similar to what they already feel inside.
Wow. Okay. So as a psychologist, you have a toolbox of ways people avoid dealing with their emotions and problems. Could you give us a couple of examples of the classic ways people avoid confronting the climate challenge?
So denial is the one we hear about the most, but that's only one kind of obvious defense. There's so many others, such as willful ignorance, which is one I personally used for many years. Willful ignorance is when you know enough to know that you don't want to know more. So I knew, this was bad. This makes me feel bad. It makes me feel anxious. So I'm just going to try and avoid it, right? Head in the sand. Intellectualization is another important one, which is where intellectually the person says, I understand human fossil fuel use and industrial agriculture are warming the planet and that's going to cause a ton of impacts. Like, I get it. But they keep it in the, like, science facts section of their mind and soul rather than really confronting with confronting and reckoning with what those facts mean on a deeply personal level. So yeah, separating out the intellectual from the emotional, which is a kind of denial. I think a lot of, say, policy wonk types are in this camp that they, yeah, there's intellectual recognition but emotional denial. Dissociation, I mentioned, I think is an extremely common defense in the United States that involves zoning out. So often with the assistance of screens or alcohol, drugs, shopping, eating, other compulsive behaviors. So just, you know, a kind of anesthetizing and distraction.
As you note in your book, some big environmental organizations downplay the negative. They call us out as alarmists or doomers. Even climate groups have failed to communicate the full truth, saying, well, the public can't handle that. You can't frighten people. But then, Margaret, what happens when the gradualist approach, and it turns out climate change is not gradual at all?
Right. What you have just identified, what I consider the worst idea in the world, which is, as you said, actually quite popular still, even today, though it is being effectively challenged. But in the gradualist climate movement, there is an idea that, quote, fear doesn't work as a motivator, so we can't tell people the whole truth. And people such as yourself and myself and the climate mobilization that do tell the truth, that we are on the precipice of the collapse of civilization, as you said, are labeled alarmists rather than the fact that the situation is alarming. It's not, I'm sorry that people feel afraid. I understand that that might not be pleasant, but do you want to look at reality or not? Yeah, I think that that has totally devastated the efficacy of the climate movement, and frankly, in many ways, set us back. The public, if environmental NGOs are broadcasting the message that things are basically fine and can be handled over the course of decades, why on earth would the public believe that the problem is worse than that, which it is? So the idea that fear doesn't work as a motivator is very negatively affecting the political situation, and it is also just laughably wrong in that fear is the most basic motivator for humans and for other animals. Fear is literally the mechanism through which we translate a perception of a risk, of a danger, into self-protective action. If our ancestors didn't feel afraid, they would have just stood there as predators got closer and closer and then took a bite, right? Fear is a self-protective mechanism, and by attempting to short-circuit it in ourselves or in the public, we put ourselves in terrible danger.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I also liked in your new book, Facing the Climate Emergency, you give the example of being at work when a fire alarm goes off and we don't see any fire or smell the smoke. Is it real or is it a false alarm? And our action may depend on how others react. So climate change can be here among us before we experience all the symptoms. And that sounds so like COVID-19, don't you think?
Absolutely. The public is getting a taste of what an exponential emergency looks like, and the fact that you must take dramatic action before the crisis is upon you, because by the time that it's all the way there, you have already lost.
Everything's changing so fast, it is hard to imagine what climate activism during and after this pandemic will look like. And I see this going on for a year or two. What do you see?
On one hand, this is a devastating turn of events for the climate movement. For example, the Earth Day, 50th anniversary of Earth Day is coming up next week. And the youth climate strikers had been planning a 3-day strike, which I believe would have been the largest ever climate demonstrations in world history. So losing that and their, you know, the general cores of organizing small in-person meetings in homes or churches or libraries, in-person protests and direct action, you know, these are true losses to our ability to effectively organize. However, there are real opportunities and opportunities for the climate movement as well, such as you noted, the parallels between COVID-19 and the climate emergency are very real, pretty clear, and already affecting public consciousness, such as, you know, the how do you pay for it argument that we hear over and over and over again about climate policies like the Green New Deal. And when the public and the media and the government are all in agreement that this is an existential crisis, then everything changes. And suddenly, we can afford dramatic action. So that's one thing, seeing how an emergency situation frees up funding, seeing countries around the world take radical measures to reorient their economy, such as Spain nationalizing their private hospitals. In France, perfume manufacturers started making disinfectant, and EM is making ventilators. So seeing how industrial mobilization on a smaller scale, but seeing how that works and why in an emergency it must happen. We are learning lessons in real time from the COVID epidemic. And back to Eric Fromm, I think perhaps the most important thing that I'm seeing, and I'm actually so happy to see, is the collective understanding that life is more important than money, and that, you know, some of the GOP and Trump wanted to reopen the economy, you know, yesterday by Easter. And we didn't do that because we wanted to protect human life. And I have been so relieved and happy to see that, because after 6 years of working on the climate emergency, I had started to fear that the necrophilic drives in humanity were ascendant and that we just weren't committed to protecting ourselves and each other. But with this emergency, I'm seeing that there really is still a collective desire to live and to protect life.
Now, you come at this with a psychological lens because of your training, and that's a great thing. But, you know, billions of people in India and China have never heard of Freud or Western psychology, and half the world's population is under the age of 30, so they don't have much connection or social memory of World War II mobilization. It makes me worry, is the climate mobilization a middle-class Western thing?
Yeah, I think to a significant degree you are correct. I hope that it is a message that can reach beyond. I hope my book has a message that can reach beyond my milieu. I hope the climate mobilization has a message that can reach beyond the United States and middle class. But I'm not sure. To some degree it does, but I'm not sure how much. But I do think that the United States has a critical role. Historically, we're the world's largest emitter and still the world's richest country, though obviously that wealth is extremely concentrated. We have the world's largest military. There's just all of these ways that if we can succeed in moving the United States, I think we can also move the world, though not necessarily with the same narrative.
With so many people stuck at home, at least for those that have a home, they maybe have time now to educate themselves on climate change and time to imagine a future we want and that we don't want and to plan our action. How can your new book help with that? And is there a Kindle version online if people can't get to closed bookstores?
Yeah, thank you so much. I really do hope that people use this time to reflect, to think about the big picture, to grieve. And of course, I would be honored if my book could be a part of that. So readers can pre-order the book or access a one-chapter free preview at facingtheclimateemergency.com. And it's also available on Amazon and other bookstores or book ordering websites.
Now, the UN advises putting climate on the back burner, their words. Margaret, what do you think?
I think that that is a mistake. I think that the coronavirus, while truly frightening and a real crisis, is a tiny fraction of what we are in for with the climate emergency. And while I understand that people are afraid of the coronavirus now, and I mean, me too, definitely, no one wants to get that virus, we are on a collision course with the collapse of civilization. And this is not in the distant future. I personally do not expect to die of natural causes in old age. I expect to die from the chaos and breakdown that the climate emergency is sowing. And I so wish that that wasn't true, but it's not a reality that we can afford to forget, even when we're facing another crisis.
Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's E-C-O, shock like an electric shock, .org.
Now, all industrialized countries have slashed emissions like never before. There are no gas-guzzling cars on many roads, and some coal-powered factories are shut down. Do you see here, when we talk about reopening the economy, do you see an opportunity to open it selectively, not to recover the former destructive normal, but getting places powered by renewable energy and producing products that are really in tune with the natural world? It seems like a really good chance.
I agree with that. Why reopen parts of the economy that are not essential and killing us? Let's use this as an opportunity to transition to something regenerative.
Talk to us about Genevieve Gunther and what she does.
Genevieve Gunther is a literature professor who has her insight and skills at analyzing language and narrative to analyze how climate is covered or not covered in the media. And she launched a project called Ending Climate Silence, which basically, I mean, they do more than this, but the heart of it is just calling out journalists on Twitter and editors and publications for reporting on stories that absolutely have a climate angle, a critical climate angle, but they leave it out. So she is not calling for more standalone stories on climate, though I'm sure she would love that. But she is calling for including the climate story in stories about, for example, drought or fires or food prices or refugees from Latin America to the U.S. I mean, these stories that are climate stories, but the media has done an absolutely terrible job of recognizing them as such. So she is calling these media sources out and also helping them to fix their error and include the climate information that needs to be included for responsible reporting.
Margaret, in a way, you go further than I do. You want to go beyond communicating about the climate, but to actually solve the climate crisis. And I don't pretend I can do that, but I do hope some of my listeners can. Would you tell us about your organization's Victory Plan?
The Victory Plan was written by Ezra Silk in 2016. It is our 100-page answer to the question that we got over and over again. What do you mean World War II-scale climate mobilization? So the Victory Plan lays out, sector by sector, how a emergency speed transition to zero and negative emission could be accomplished if you remove the barriers of political intransigence and denial that are currently swamping our political conversation on climate. So if the country entered emergency mode on climate, like we are on coronavirus, but even more so because it's an even worse problem, what could be possible? So we advocate policies in the victory plan, such as an immediate ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure, no new refineries, no new export terminals, and a early retirement of our existing fossil fuel capacity so that we would shut, gradually phase out all fossil fuel use by 2030. We call for a ban on factory farms and a five-year transition off pesticides. We call for a huge investment in renewable energy and public transportation and an immediate change to an all-electric vehicle standard, so no producing vehicles with internal combustion engines anymore. Call for carbon farming and regenerative agriculture that binds carbon into the soil and also food security. We call for a massive energy conservation project, which includes like insulating every home, and we call for building a super smart grid. It's incredibly ambitious and shows that we could solve these problems. We have the political technical tools that we need. What we don't have is the political will.
As we wrap up here, Margaret, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
As you mentioned, the climate mobilization has been one of the pioneers of the Climate Emergency Declaration campaign, which has won more than 1,400 governments declaring a climate emergency. We're always looking for more organizers and organizations to join that work. So if you're interested, come to theclimatemobilization.org and join in.
We've been speaking with the founder of the Climate Mobilization, Margaret Klein Salomon. Find her new book, Facing the Climate Emergency, How to Transform Yourself with Climate Truth, at New Society Publishers or anywhere books are sold online. Margaret, you really are a power in your own right. You have made some big changes. Thank you for talking with us again.
Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.